Thank you. That was excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody. It's really terrific to be here tonight, and I want to thank the Beijing Center for hosting me. James, thank you so much. Thank you for that excellent introduction. Let me just say a word about why I'm here in China. I'm here in China because in just a few days, I've put together a fairly large conference, bringing together 8 American scholars and 8 prominent Chinese scholars. We're going to hold this at Tsinghua. We're going to have a 2-day conference, and we're going to talk about the security implications or the military implications of China's rise. What's different about this conference is that in order for you to be invited to this conference, if you were an American, you weren't allowed to speak Chinese. So for many decades, we have been debating China's rise. And for many decades, this has been in a very important area where scholars, American scholars, not all American scholars, but mostly American scholars who speak Chinese and who know a ton about China, who know a ton about China's culture, a ton about China's history, a ton about China's economy, a ton about China's military forces, have been focusing on this issue. And we have learned, and the world has learned, and I hope people even in China have learned, a fair bit from that debate. And I think that's been an extremely important debate, and I don't mean to minimize it at all. But there are other groups of scholars. There are groups of scholars who focus on the theory of international politics. They too are interested in China, but China is not the centerpiece of what they have been doing for 20 or so years, although it has been an important part. And so finding out what they think about this important issue is very important. And up until now, a number of those scholars, I'll mention John Mearsheimer a bit later, they have talked about China in their work. They've written a paragraph or two at the end of their books. But to give you an example, John is coming to our conference, and he has now written a 50-page single-space paper, which will about this issue, and it is going to be published as a new chapter coming at the end of Tragedy. This is Andy Moravchek. A number of scholars that I've just described fit this bill. People who are very knowledgeable about the theory of international politics, but not just simply the theory of international politics. There's another group of scholars who have spent 20 years or more studying war. And I mean they've studied war in all kinds of contexts. They've studied major power war in the past, in history. They've studied more contemporary wars, wars that the United States has been involved with, say, since the end of the Cold War. They've studied wars that don't involve states, terrorism. I've also invited those scholars to come, because keep in mind, what we're talking about is not just simply an issue of China, and it's not just simply an issue of international politics, it's an issue of war. It's an issue of military. And so it would just be very helpful to bring that group of scholars to the table as well. So anyway, that's the general purpose of this conference. As you heard from my introduction, you heard some of the books that I've published, and you notice that that war issue comes up quite a bit. Well, for the last 25 years, I've studied a whole variety of issues of war. And what I want to do is talk to you about the implications of China's rise from that perspective. I don't mean to tell you they have every corner and of every market here. I'm just trying to tell you a bit about this from my perspective, and I'm hoping that it will help to enrich the debate. And I think that what it's going to do is, as we talk about the issues, certainly the way I see the issues, I think you're going to see that, in fact, as I see the issues, it is no surprise to me that in recent times we've seen actually quite a bit of Sino-American cooperation in military disputes, say last April with North Korea. We actually saw not just simply detente, not just simply getting along, but actual cooperation. I think that's the norm. I think that is, in fact, increasingly going to be the norm. And I think the more we know about the military dynamics, about what's at issue, I think it will help to explain why the range of outcomes is not really around a Cold War or around rivalry, but it's much, much closer to a deep cooperation. And a deep cooperation, I might add, not built on economic interdependence. So So I'm not going to talk to you about the economic interdependence of the countries. I'm going to talk about the military issues as I see them, because I think those are actually what's underneath this growing cooperation, and that's really what I want to talk about. Now, to get there, let me just begin with somebody just help me with the, thank you, wrong one. I'm sure that numerous people have come to you and opened their talks with the trajectories of economic growth of the United States and China. I just want to show you the latest trajectories from the IMF. There are multiple ways to track China's rising power. Almost all of them deal with China's economic growth as the crucial point. Why is that? I told you, I study war, I study military affairs. Why am I starting with the economy? It's because, not because I'm forgetting that power in any snapshot in time is ultimately military power. It's because over even just the time span of just a few years, what matters to a country's power is its economic strength. Because ultimately, that's the constraint on what it can choose to do to build forces. Its size of its economy. That is the taproot of military power. This is for just anything beyond even just a few years, for all states, which is why the rise and fall of great powers and major powers over time has largely been a function of the rise and fall of their economies. Well, if we look at the rise of China's economy, that's the red, and we look at the subsequent decline of America's economy, as tracked by the percentage of their gross domestic product as a fraction of world GNP, and using the key measure of that, which is used by the IMF, the World Bank, and the CIA, they all agree that the best way to track relative GDP of states is with purchasing power parity. This is the measure, as some of you may know, that best controls for inflation, that best controls for differences in labor rates, that best controls for corrupt figures by governments that put out information that we can't best track. It's not perfect. It has its own flaws, but it is the best measure that we use. Well, looking at that measure, what you can see is that there has been this steady movement of China and the United States where the lines have gotten closer and closer together. Now, the hard data on these lines stops at 2012, according to the IMF. But every year, the IMF pushes out its projections about 5 years, and you can see what's happening in the next 5 years. That is, from 2014 to 2018, the two lines are about to touch, or almost about to touch. This is a seminal moment in international relations. This is not just simply lines coming together. Already, China's growth as a fraction of America's growth is well beyond the peak of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union never got to greater than 55% of America's GNP. It's well beyond Japan. Japan never got beyond 41%. And China is about to cross America. The last time the world's leading economy was overtaken by another economy was when the United States overtook Britain in 1890. That's over 120 years ago. So the events that we're about to see happen in the next 5 years, 10 years, not 30 years and not 50 years, but in the next 5 to 10 years are truly going to be seminal events in international politics. And these are events that not just realists, but scholars and policymakers have been arguing about the consequences for many hundreds of years, not just in the context of China, but for many hundreds of years. In fact, going back thousands of years. The classic view, when you have the leading state of the system in relative decline and a clear challenger, that is one state that's clearly about to overtake it, The classic view, going back to Thucydides, is this is a prescription for war. This is a prescription for war because the leading state in the international system derives benefits from being the leading state in the international system. They have the most say in the world, and they want to hold on to that say. The challenging state would also like to get those benefits, and therefore they're willing to pay some costs, maybe even take risks of war to get those benefits. Well, that's not just simply an old view. Realists today, and that's, I'll just quote John Mearsheimer, he's a realist, he's one of the professors from the University of Chicago. He's somebody I know, I've known for over 25 years quite well. I think highly of John, I respect him tremendously. He agrees with this view. He believes that these trajectories are pointing in a direction that's going to lead toward fundamental conflict. That is, not just simply a little bit of dust-up tension, but he means war. He means war between the United States and China. I don't think that's where we're heading. In fact, I think we're heading toward a deep cooperation, the opposite of this view. It's not because I'm going to pull a fast one and say, oh yeah, those military factors don't matter. Military factors don't matter, and therefore it's only economics, and therefore we're just going to live in a world where we're going to get wealthy and we're going to forget about those benefits of running the system. No, I want to focus on some military factors to, within the box of military factors, try to explain to you why we're heading toward cooperation. That's taking the realist case head on. It's not bypassing it by moving in the direction of economics. And let's just talk about that view a little bit. First, let me develop the pessimist view a little bit more so that you can see their case, so that we understand what we're dealing with. Basically, the pessimists are making a rational case for conflict. They're not making an irrational case. They're making a rational case. The basic argument is that there are benefits at issue. China would gain supreme security by being a hegemon in Asia. A hegemon in Asia would be the dominant state in Asia with no interference, not just simply from Taiwan, South Korea, or Japan, but especially the United States, getting rid of the United States. The basic argument is this would provide China supreme security and benefits. On the cost side, the pessimists understand we live in a nuclear world, but for them, they see nuclear weapons as providing security or stability to both sides in this equation. For the pessimists in this view, they see that China has nuclear weapons, they see the United States has nuclear weapons, and they therefore think they just simply cancel out, almost as if those nuclear weapons weren't there in the first place. So the world, even though we live in a nuclear age, for the pessimists, looks an awful lot like the pre-nuclear age. They grant they exist, but then rule them out as a factor in international politics. On the side of war, they look at the geography of Asia. They see that Asia has a lot of water, but what that water has done is essentially dispersed China's targets. So China doesn't have to take on Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan all at once. China can pick its targets one at a time, and therefore can essentially fight a series of sequential wars or coercive battles, not necessarily outright shooting wars. And for them, the benefits of that approach for China would outweigh the costs. And as Mearsheimer sees it, and as other realists see it, this is the prescription for real conflict in the coming decades. Not just simply a minor set of crises, say over an island incident where there's a captain of a boat that's taken by the Japanese, and therefore we have some diplomatic dispute, but we mean real shooting that happens. That's their case, and I don't think that it stands up. But I think it doesn't stand up, not because they're missing economic factors or issues of China's history and how its aims are limited. I think those are all true too, by the way. I'm not disputing that. I think it doesn't hold up on straight military factors, and that's what I want to talk about. What's missing, I believe, from the pessimist case, and I think is inadequately emphasized, at least in what I currently read, consume in the debate on China's rise, is a true appreciation of the nuclear revolution. I think that what's really missing is the understanding that the coming of nuclear weapons is not where one side has weapons, another side has nuclear weapons, and therefore they cancel out in the politics between the states. I think that, in fact, with the coming of nuclear weapons, they play a tremendous role in dampening the prospects for escalation once any crisis starts. Now, I'm not going so far as to say that there will be no crises or no incidents that would occur in Asia or no local crisis. I'm not telling you that there will not be a future crisis where North Korea decides to move a mobile missile and that sets off a lot of tension in the region. I'm not telling you that it's impossible that Taiwan could demand independence, setting off another crisis. There's actually multiple ways where crises can occur in Asia, as is true in Europe and other parts of the world. What I am telling you is there are some very good reasons for believing that those initial crises emerge. The coming of the nuclear revolution means there will be tremendous pressure on both the United States and China to work together to dampen those crises. I believe we've already seen that over the last 15 years, and I believe we're going to see that even more, and I don't believe that this is going to change with China's rise. So in effect, what I believe is going to happen is we'll have the issue of war, direct nuclear war, taken off the table. I think that that's also then going to mean that we will not have tense 1950s-style Cold War crises where there truly were proxy wars between the major powers, where there truly were nuclear alerts between the major powers, where there truly was the movement of large-scale conventional forces into crisis areas once those crises emerged. I believe that will be taken off the table as well, and that's what I really want to talk to you about. And so what I think we'll be left with is a range of security, rivalry, and cooperation. And I think we're going to be heading closer to the cooperation side of the spectrum. And that's, again, what I'm hoping to persuade you of by the end. Now, why don't I think there'll be a Cold War between the United States and China? Let me give you three brief reasons, and then I want to develop one of those in depth to really make my point. The first, and I've already sort of foreshadowed it, is nuclear weapons, the nuclear revolution. I think this is of paramount importance, and I'm going to talk about that in a little more depth in just a moment. The second is the geography of the region, especially the fact that most of the potential conflicts we have in Asia are going to be conflicts that exist in large bodies of water. Water is an incredibly important military factor. Why is that? It's because water has the effect of slowing down and making more difficult any possible offensive action. Water has the effect of making it extremely difficult, not impossible, but extremely difficult for there to be a bolt from the blue conquest that comes out of nowhere that suddenly ends a conflict. That's very important because if in fact conflict must be a process, as I'll explain in just a moment, that process can lead reasonable decision makers who might not have been surprised in the early stages of a crisis to realize their best move is to calm down the crisis. And I believe that on the geography of Asia, far from making it easier to fight wars, is actually going to make it more easy. The thing it's going to make easier is calming down crises as they occur. And that's for straightforward, again, military reasons. The third military factor is America's military presence in Asia. I believe America's military presence in Asia serves a tremendous pacifying effect in Asia. Not because America's military presence can be calibrated in a precise way to counteract specific scenarios we might paint. So possibly you have been through this, I have been through numerous of these over the last 20 years, Taiwan scenarios, where we kind of envision here is the either the missile strikes or the blockade or the amphibious landing or the airborne landing. I used to work for the U.S. Air Force, so we'd go through all of these. And we can project all the different capabilities and then all the different counter capabilities. That's not what I mean by the importance of military, America's military presence. What's important about America's military presence is not the exact type of capability that America has to counter the exact type of capability that China or some other state may have in a scenario. What's important about America's military presence is that it is in the region and serves as an unmistakable and unavoidable commitment by the United States to the region. And as I'm going to explain in just a moment, it also means as long as we have troops in Japan, South Korea, and near Taiwan, it means this will pose inescapable risks to China. They can't get out of this. Not very easily, not for a long time to come. And I think they realize that, which is why we have seen China and the United States working together to dampen crises. But it's about just simply their presence, something I'll come back to in just a moment. So, the heart of what I want to talk about is the issue of how crises escalate. Because as I said, we are going to live in a world where there are going to be local crises in Asia. We have already lived in a world where there are local crises in Asia. If those crises exist, the pessimists believe those are going to be opportunities to have them escalate. And they believe that as China gets stronger, the tensions between the United States and China will grow worse, and therefore the reasons or the rational reasons to escalate a crisis as it comes along are going to grow. I don't think that's going to be the case. I think that with the nuclear revolution, we have a very different way to think about crises. I think this is why the second half of the Cold War was much calmer than the first half of the Cold War, and why already the last 20 years of China's growth has been the calmest yet. And let me just kind of explain the logic and give you a little bit of empirics behind the logic. What I want to do is talk about the logic of how to think about a crisis, an international crisis between two states that have nuclear weapons, and when I say nuclear weapons, I mean secure second strike forces. That is unmistakable retaliatory capability to be able to harm each other with nuclear weapons. If we think about a crisis that way, think about a crisis not as one hot spot of, oh my God, we have a crisis and we've just explained this awful outcome. Think about it as a process. Think about it as a process. Now, it's a little hard to do this in peacetime, but this is in fact what happens in crisis times. And if you can roll back to maybe last April, when we started to have this quasi-nuclear crisis with North Korea, notice how very quickly, once the crisis began, we didn't think immediately of the awful outcome that could come. We started to think of the process, the steps along the way, so that we understood that conflict wasn't, for especially between with nuclear weapons are involved, wasn't just simply a yes-no decision. There was a process of steps along the way, and we started to understand the significance of each move. Well, let me be clear about those steps and unpack them in four steps. The first, D1, is the initial crisis. That initial crisis could come either by a move by one of the major powers or not. If you want to think of an example, think of D1 here as Taiwan declares independence or demands independence. Not something China did, not something the United States did, but it can start a crisis. On the very far end, D4. Think about that as nuclear use. Nuclear use. That's the very far end, which in the beginning of a crisis, nobody wants. The United States doesn't want this. China doesn't want this. But let's look at the middle of the crisis, because that's really the important part of the politics of states with nuclear weapons. And it's the important part that I think is generally left out of our discussions of whether a war would escalate with China. There's a D2 and a D3. D2 is the first conventional deployment. Think about that as D1, Taiwan demands independence. D2 is China institutes a blockade, moves naval forces for a blockade. D2 can also involve that period, some moves by the other side. Think about this as the period where maybe the United States counter moves some of its naval forces close to sort of offset China's blockade. But then we have D3, or we're heading toward a D3. What is D3? D3 is the first lethal move where one of the major powers or the other inflicts casualties on the military forces of the other side. This could be, in this scenario, China sinking an American naval vessel, or the United States sinking a Chinese naval vessel. What matters here is not the ultimate outcome of the blockade. What matters is hundreds, if not thousands, of your opponent's troops have died, and that opponent has nuclear weapons. Once we reach a D3, where we've actually inflicted casualties on the other side, what's going to happen between D3 and D4? No one knows. And that's the point. At this stage, once we've pulled this apart as a process, what I'm telling you is that we can see, and decision makers see, that as they move through the process of a crisis with nuclear weapons, where both states have nuclear weapons, they can clearly see the moments where both sides start to lose control. And the crucial moment is when one side inflicts casualties on the other. Because after that point, do they really know how their adversary is going to respond? Well, they might like to hope that it would just be a tit-for-tat response. But what does a tit-for-tat response mean in this situation? Think of the United States. You know, we get hit on 9/11. 3,000 Americans die. We go in and we invade Afghanistan. And what happens? We took it over too fast. And so the American public and half the American elite is demanding what? Another war. Another war. Was that the rational thing to do? I will tell you, probably not. I don't think so. Did that happen because of the politics of escalation? I would tell you almost surely. Nuclear crisis, or in a local crisis between powers, states that have nuclear weapons, this dynamic where there is a point where each side can lose control, that's the scary thought. That's the scary thought. It's not a scary thought for one side or the other. It's not just simply that, oh, the Americans will get scared. They won't want to go there. Or the Chinese will get scared. They won't want to go there. Both sides can start to see in this four-step process, there's a D3. And they don't want to go to D3. Because once they go to D3, there's no telling that they're going to be able to stop it from going to D4. I'm not telling you they're going to want it to go there. What I'm telling you is it can spin out of control. Now, let me use this little model here of these four steps to talk about some cases, some examples. Because we've never actually had a case where we've had a crisis between two major powers with secure second strike forces that's gone to D3. Think about that. Never. Okay. Had a lot of crises between the United States and the Soviet Union. The worst was the missile crisis. So let me use this little framework to talk to you about the Cuban Missile Crisis. The Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962. D1, the Soviets decide to install some missiles, some nuclear capable, they didn't actually have warheads on them at the time, but some nuclear capable missiles in Cuba. We discover this creates a crisis. In this case, one of the major powers started the crisis, but still, that's D1. D2, the United States instituted a blockade of Cuba, surrounded Cuba with a quarantine, a naval blockade of Cuba. Also in this period of D2, what happened on the Soviet side? They started to bring their naval forces toward the blockade with nuclear weapons on, we thought, to match them to the missiles, to run the blockade. And what would it mean to run the blockade? That would mean their naval forces would engage with our naval forces and sink each other's ships, or kill hundreds of each other. Well, as that naval blockade came into place, and as the Soviet forces came closer and closer, they got almost eyeball to eyeball, and then the Soviets pulled back. They simply would not kill the Americans to cross that blockade. Why? Because very clear, if you cross into D3, very difficult to know what was coming after that point. The loss of control, the fear that that crisis could easily spin out of control to D4 was too much, and both sides actually pulled back. Let me use another example, one maybe you're more familiar with, the 1996 Taiwan crisis. Starting actually in 1995, but continuing to 1996, China decided to lob missiles near ports in Taiwan to try to coerce Taiwan, especially the population, into changing its vote in the Taiwanese elections in March 1996. Those missile strikes occurred, and something I'm not sure you're familiar with, and if you're not, you might want to go and look this up. On January 25th in the New York Times in 1996, there was a very interesting article. There was an interesting article because the chief of staff of the PLA had a meeting here in Beijing with an American diplomat, Charles Freeman. And in that meeting, he told Freeman that it was going to be possible for China to get its way with Taiwan because, quote, China cares more about Taiwan, Taipei, than the United States does about Los Angeles. That quote went right to the White House. That is what it means to hint at the use of nuclear weapons. Now, of course, we can downplay that and we can say, oh, that has, you know, we shouldn't take that kind of a quote seriously, except it is from the chief of staff of the PLA. So, number one. And number two, if you knew more about the history of nuclear crises, that's exactly the kind of hints at nuclear crises that existed in the past. That is, if you think that that very impressive whiff of nuclear gunpowder, you'd be right, but you'd also be missing that's nuclear weapons are so dangerous, and that prospect of D4 is so bad, it does not take much to scare the bejesus out of both sides in simply mentioning those nuclear weapons. Well, so what happened in this crisis? What happened in the crisis is we had a D1. We actually had a D2. We had the conventional use of missiles by China. What did the United States do in this case? Again, if you don't know this part, you should go and find out. We decided, after giving that information, to sail two American aircraft carriers directly into the Taiwan Straits and leave them there for 4 days. Why did we do that? That was our move at D2. What we're basically telling the Chinese is we have not just forces in the region, we have people in the region. Each of those carriers carries 5,000 Americans. Sink one of those carriers, you kill 5,000 Americans, you're now at D3. And what happened? the crisis calmed down almost immediately. Nobody went to D3. Nobody went to D3. The missiles stopped. Actually, Li Teng-hui got more than the vote he was supposed to get, according to the polls. So this was not a very successful coercive effort by China. And American side pulled back too. In cases, both the Cuban Missile Crisis and the one case we've had so far with China and the United States, we can apply this fourfold framework, and we can see that no one wants to go to D3. It's just way too dangerous. And as a result, what we're going to see are more instances, probably not even getting to D2 as we saw in the Taiwan Straits crisis in 96. I think that what we have seen here is that even in the case of China, even where there's nationalism that could be pushing China to be edgy, even when there's worry by the United States they could be losing their status as the world's sole superpower, I think the nuclear revolution is having a tremendous calming effect on local crises in Asia, and I think that that calming effect is going to continue. So, it does turn on some details of China's nuclear capability. If you're really interested in the talk, I'm glad to go through and discuss those. I think you'll grant me that China has nuclear capability, but if you want to know the details, I'm glad to do it in the talk. But I'm not going to take time to do it unless you really want to know. But what do I think about the future? What I think is that in the future, we're going to see a deeper security cooperation between the United States and China. And I think it's going to occur along several dimensions. First, China's own security interests. Many people debate whether China would like to kick America out of the region because, as Mearsheimer and other realist pessimists think, America is kind of a thorn in China's side. And if China really wants to be a true regional hegemon like the United States, America, it should kick American forces out of the region. I look at this through a different lens. I look at this through the lens of the nuclear revolution. What I see is that America's presence in Japan, South Korea, near other hotspots in the region, is essentially pacifying and calming other Asian rivals who, if you took the American presence out, would end up escalating and building up their own military capability. Or let me put this another way. China has a deep security interest in keeping us here. I think it would be against China's security interests to kick us out. It may be that people may claim that, oh, China would like for nationalist reasons to be autonomous and independent, but just think for a moment. What would China's future look like if instead of America's presence calming down South Korea in a crisis or Japan in a crisis or being able to curtain Taiwan from pushing too hard for independence, none of that pacifying effect was there. And suddenly each of those individual states on their own could decide what level of military or nuclear forces they wanted to build. I think the answer is very clear. It would be a deep mistake for China to want to kick us out because then the local arms races would be way too intense, much worse. So as I see it, China has, number one, an interest in keeping American presence in the region. Number two, American interests. I think the United States has no interest in arms racing China, building a containment, counterbalancing coalition that's going to surround China and kind of come at it from a whole variety of ways. Why do we want to scare China into growing its military capability? China has a growing economy. It could take part more of that economy and put it into military force. If we, the United States, were to build a counterbalancing coalition, why wouldn't China do that? And therefore, we end up just simply in another arms race. I think this is not in America's interests. I think that's why it's not happening. I think the United States realizes this would be a mistake, and we're not pushing hard to arm. So what do I see? I see that both the United States and China have a deep interest in stability in Asia. I think that we have a deep interest in essentially pacifying what would otherwise be local spirals that could spiral out of control. And that joint interest in stability is at the taproot of what I believe is this coming special relationship with China. I do believe that economic interdependence matters. I do believe that it's the case that China's aims are culturally and historically limited. I'm not doubting that for a moment. But I think at the taproot of the stability of Asia is actually the joint interest that the United States and China has in that stability. And I think in the nuclear age, they would be very foolish to do otherwise. And in the nuclear age, as much as we don't like to talk about nuclear weapons, nuclear weapons, ladies and gentlemen, can sometimes be a good thing. I'm not telling you they're always a good thing. I'm not in love with nuclear weapons. But let me tell you that if we took the nuclear weapons out of the equation between China and the United States, then I'm afraid the Mearsheimer logic of the world could well be true. Even with the deep economic interdependence that we see between the United States and China, you take the nuclear pacifying effects out of the equation as I'm describing them, and we may well live in that realist pessimist world. It's actually the nuclear revolution that I believe is bringing peace to Asia. And with that, let me stop there. Thank you.